that individual. And although there are tests which are available to help exclude other causes, so in young people you can exclude rare metabolic causes, and you can do scans which look at a thing called dopamine in the brain and show it's deficient in people with the right clinical symptoms and signs, that only helps you make the diagnosis because the deficiency of dopamine can be seen in other conditions. So at the end of the day, you normally get the diagnosis right when you first see somebody, if you're a specialist in that area, about 9 times out of 10. But that still means that 1 in 10 people have an initial diagnosis of Parkinson's, which subsequently proves not to be the case. And those other diagnoses are often a tremor, so the thing called essential tremor, or one of these so-called Parkinsonian plus conditions. Now, that has implications. It obviously has implications because you're telling the patient they've got a disease they haven't got. It also means when we come to trials, it can be a problem. So 1 in 10 people, if you're treating de novo Parkinson's patients, don't actually have the condition you think they've got. So if your treatment is designed around a therapy for Parkinson's, then 1 in 10 of your patients will actually fail your trial simply because you've got the wrong diagnosis. So one of the big challenges in the world of Parkinson's disease is to try and improve on that diagnostic capability. And that obviously improves if you follow people over time because you can see how they develop. How they respond to therapy is often a very big clue. But as we've been hearing in other sessions, these pre-motor, prodromal features of Parkinson's can be quite helpful. So in my own practice back in the UK, when I see people who may have very early Parkinson's disease, one of the very useful ways to try and establish that diagnosis is not only through conventional examination and possibly doing these dopamine scans, these DAT scans, but is asking people very specifically about other deficits which they may not volunteer when they come to clinic. So the absence of smell, have you lost your sense of smell over the last few years? And some patients will say that happened a number of years before they went to their doctor with their abnormalities, with their movement. Acting out dreams at night, the so-called REM sleep behavioural disorder, is another common feature of prodromal and early Parkinson's disease. And then you can ask other things about slowing up with walking, have other people noticed you look a little bit depressed, you're a bit depressed, and things of that nature. Now, none of themselves are helpful, because if I went down the high street of any city and said to people, have you noticed a problem with your smell, a problem with your sleep, a problem with your walking, your mood, your bowel, or things like that, then every single person would say yes to one aspect of it. But those positive answers to those questions in the context of someone who has very subtle abnormalities or very difficult to pick up signs is a very helpful way of establishing the diagnosis. So the real challenge for Parkinson's in the future, if you like, is being able to diagnose the condition early. And as we've also heard, it may ultimately end up that the diagnosis of Parkinson's is not made by neurologists or movement disorder specialists, but by people in other disciplines because of this problem with sleep and smell and possibly bowel problems. Having reliable markers, which you can say definitely correlate and predict that you have Parkinson's disease, not that they increase your chance, that would be a good starting point, that they make it more likely you've got it, but actually definitively linked to it. And if we can do that, that is important not only to tell people that they've got the condition which you think they've got, but it also has implications because the future, I would say, of the treatment of Parkinson's disease is hitting patients with therapies very early on in a much more aggressive way than we perhaps do at the moment, or in fact treatments which we don't currently have. So at the moment, that's what I would say the state of play is with respect to diagnosing Parkinson's disease. And I'm happy to take any questions on that. My honest answer is no. I think there could be tests which will help. So we're going to hear a little bit later about biomarkers. So I suspect what will happen in the future is you'll have someone who sounds as though they've got Parkinson's from what they tell you. They have subtleties and features on examination which fit with Parkinson's disease. You may do a scan to show that they have a deficiency of dopamine on the scan. And then you may be able to use blood markers which give you an extra clue that it's that coupled to the scan, coupled to the signs, coupled to the symptoms, makes it more likely you've got Parkinson's. I would be very surprised if there is a way you could go along to the doctor, they take a blood sample, they take it to the lab and then come back saying, you got Parkinson's disease. Okay, yep, sure.
I'm conscious of everybody's time.
Okay.
I'm concerned I want everybody to have so don't forget your questions, save it for the end, okay? Thank you.
Can I speak from here? Is this mic on?
Sorry, I'm John Stanford. I'm sorry, I'm running terribly late, unfortunately. I was chairing another session, which is run about 15 minutes late. But just give you a little bit of background on myself. I'm a slightly unusual beast in the sense that at this meeting, I kind of represent all facets of the meeting at the same time. I was originally a neuroscientist. I trained in neuroscience at the University of Bath, and for many years was actually a researcher heading a group looking at the dopamine terminals in Parkinson's disease. And then I was diagnosed myself with Parkinson's disease in 2006, and as my wife said at the time, trust you to go that little bit further in your training. It wasn't quite what I had in mind, needless to say, but it's proved quite an interesting journey for me, changing from being essentially a pure scientist like Professor Barker, not perhaps as esteemed as Professor Barker, I should say, but to being essentially a patient advocate and increasingly looking at the role of patients in terms of guiding research direction, I suppose, as much as anything else in the future. And that's an area which I'm very actively interested and involved in. If I could actually just introduce the panel formally, I'm not sure, I don't think we've done this. So firstly, on my immediate right is Professor Roger Barker, whose research areas include studies of biomarkers, cell therapies, and developing novel treatments. He's also a coordinator of the TransEuro project, which is probably of quite a significant interest. It's a European research consortium focused on studying effective and safe fetal cell-based transplants for Parkinson's. To his immediate right is Professor Chesley, Marie-Françoise Chesley, who is a professor of neurology and distinguished professor and chair in the Department of Neurobiology at David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and director of the Gene Environment in Parkinson's Disease Program at the Center for Gene Environment in Parkinson's Disease at UCLA. And to Marie-Françoise's right is Michael Schlossmacher. He's a senior scientist in the neuroscience program here in terms of Canada from the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute and an associate professor of medicine and specializing in neurology and director of the MD-PhD program at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. Happy to take questions across the board.
Should we continue following instructions? All right. So good morning. It's still the morning. I was asked to talk about recovery of cells. And of course, that's a critical aspect of Parkinson's disease because we know it's a neurodegenerative disorder. Cells in the brain die in Parkinson's disease. So can we recover them? I think that's really the central question at the moment in research and clinical aspects of Parkinson's disease, because at the moment we only have symptomatic treatment. We have, to a certain extent, fairly good symptomatic treatment compared to what we had 40 years ago, and they have continued to improve over the last 40 years. But we don't have neuroprotection yet. So can we hope for neuroprotection? Well, something you will see written very often is that by the time a patient is diagnosed, it's too late because that patient has already lost 80 or more percent of their dopaminergic neurons. I think that's a view that's very pessimistic and to a certain extent is wrong. It's wrong for two reasons. First, even if a patient has already lost a lot of cells at diagnosis, we all know that there is a huge difference in the quality of life of someone who has the first signs of Parkinson's disease and someone who has an advanced disease. So obviously, there is a progression, and we should be able to stop the process during this progression and to recover the cells that will continue to die, or the pathological process that will continue to progress. I also think it's wrong because I think we overestimated how many cells a patient has lost at the time of diagnosis. I think the patients has dysfunctional cells. They don't function properly, but they may still be there. And if they are still there, they can be saved. They are dysfunctional cells. It's not useful to save dysfunctional cells, but it's very useful to make dysfunctional cells function better. And certainly the experiments that have been going on in experimental models, in animal models over the last 10 years, have shown that you can recover cells that are dysfunctional. And in our animal models, we can improve deficits that are already established with a variety of new strategies. So I think we can be very hopeful that we can recover cells in Parkinson's.
Marie-Françoise, can I just briefly just paraphrase what you're saying? In terms of dysfunctional cells, essentially what you mean is that the cells are still there, they're detectable in the substantia nigra, but they just stop producing dopamine at the terminals. So they've gone to sleep, in essence.
And it's true not only for the dopaminergic cells, but it's probably also true for other cells in the brain that are responsible for a lot of the other symptoms of Parkinson's disease. We have heard and will hear more about not only the motor symptoms, but the depression, the problems with memories, and problem with sleep. This is a pathology that continues to evolve after diagnosis and may be responsible for the increasing disability of the patient. And those cells also are dysfunctional. So our strategy should not be limited to saving dopaminergic neurons, but to really focus on the mechanism that makes not only the dopamine neurons, but other cells in the brain dysfunctional, and stop this mechanism so that we can recover the function of those cells.
And I think it's following on from that, it's essentially, it would be reasonable to say that our clinical measures of function, as it were, probably overestimate the extent of damage. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Hello, everybody. Bonjour. The topic that was assigned to me is that of biomarkers. Biomarkers, as introduced briefly by Dr. Barker, relate to our ability to diagnose a particular condition, such as Parkinson's disease. And you may know very well that there's a variety of different biomarkers in other diseases, such as when we have cholesterol problems with high lipids and that puts it at risk for stroke or heart disease. We can go to the doctor and have a laboratory test done. Or when somebody has a crushing chest pain, we can get a very sensitive and accurate assessment of whether a heart attack has occurred or has not occurred. So this is the topic of a biomarker based on laboratory testing, like blood testing or spinal fluid testing. And in Parkinson's disease, as you've heard earlier, one of the difficulties that we face is that the timely diagnosis of a patient with diagnosis is still not 100% reliable for every single practitioner, nurse, or doctor out there. So we need to improve that. Why? Well, there are two main reasons. Number one is the sooner we can diagnose accurately whether somebody has Parkinson's or Parkinson's look-alike problem, we can treat them. And we know from numerous studies that when you're being treated earlier, you function better with your activities of daily living. And the second thing is we need to have an instrument that allows us to ultimately test therapeutic interventions, new drugs, et cetera, to see whether they make a difference or not over the course of time. And currently, as you've heard earlier from Dr. Barker, we can assess people and communicate the suspicion of Parkinson's. We can obtain information at the time of death, or we can get information with fancy, expensive scans. But those scans actually only show change after, hi, Virginia, after 18 months. So they're not as quick. And these instruments, these markers, would be really helpful for clinical studies when drug companies want to test a new drug. So my job was to just very briefly summarize as to what has happened over the last year on that topic, for instance, of biomarkers, and where do we stand in Parkinson's, that they help us with a better diagnostic assessment, not based on the doctor asking the patient to do certain movements, not based on a fancy scan, but is there anything laboratory-wise? And one of the members of the audience asked about a blood test earlier. So let me, however, and I agree with Dr. Barker's response, that there's nothing really fantastic in terms of a breakthrough that allows us to do a blood test, like a cholesterol level test. But a lot has happened on the front of spinal fluid analysis. That's the fluid that invades our brains, and one can collect it very safely from the back of the spine with a lumbar puncture. And there's been a lot of really exciting stuff going on this year, and two important publications were just coming out over the last few months, one actually in September, where Virginia's husband was involved as well. This was pioneered by the Michael J. Fox Foundation. They started a cohort that you may have heard of that's called the Progressive Parkinson's Marker Initiative, or PPMI, and we helped them develop a test which was applied to a first cohort of people, 100 people with Parkinson's or no Parkinson's, without any treatment yet, so they're very early, to look at what the spinal fluid pattern reveals. And there's some exciting information there that shows early on in the disease already changes in the markers that were selected. And we've also published this in another cohort at the beginning of the year in a German cohort. So it's not just true for North American patients, but elsewhere too. However, these changes are very subtle. When you have a heart attack, you can differentiate everybody with or without a heart attack based on a blood test. And with the spinal fluid tests, we're not there yet. There's too much overlap. We can't separate who has and who doesn't have disease yet. But it's a first step toward coming up with new markers that will allow us to hopefully better differentiate that. And why is that important in summary, and to basically put this in perspective? We need to match a person with the accurate diagnosis with the best possible drug in clinical trials in the future. And for that, we need objective parameters, not just what the doctor thinks or what the patient thinks, but also what the laboratory test shows. So that's on the fluid side. And on the non-fluid side, Dr. Barker also mentioned, there's a lot of work being done as to what other features than motor features, meaning tremor, slowness, or stiffness, arise. And we have now a really nice compendium of tests that we can do to discern in patients what else is not right, such as sleep difficulty, smell dysfunction, so they have a reduced sense of smell very early on, gastrointestinal difficulty. And believe it or not, we can even pick up some trace abnormalities in EKGs now in people with Parkinson's, as we have ultrasounds of the brain. And so when you combine all of these non-motor features, believe it or not, in very organized, nice trials, that one of which has just been published in the Journal of Neurology this month, you can tease out correctly 93% of people who have Parkinson's, not based on their motor symptoms, but based on others. And as you just heard earlier, there's a lot of other cells that are involved in Parkinson's, and so these tests target those associated dysfunction. So in summary, in my opinion, there's a lot of optimism that we are going to capture that illness better, both on an objective laboratory marker level as well as an objective assessment of other non-motor problems, so not just tremor, slowness, and stiffness. And I think that sense of optimism is shared, that we will be able to bring something to companies, clinical trial organizers, more reliable tools to ultimately help assess is a drug working or not working by using some of these markers.
So if I could just introduce the last two speakers who've done a lot of work on alpha-synuclein, which is Dr. Lee and Dr. Fishbein. Dr. Lee has hot-footed it from the same session I was in, so but slightly slower than me, which is impressive. So
that's right. I apologize for being a little bit late. So the alpha-synuclein and this whole issue of protein misfolding, it's not only and happened to alpha-synuclein, but it's a common problem with all different neurodegenerative diseases, like particularly Alzheimer's and Lou Gehrig's disease and so on. And so I think that the first thing I want you to understand is what do we mean by protein misfolding? It's sort of a you know, big word. And for some of you who actually went to Dr. Brunden's talk, I think he probably said it in the best way, in the sense that normally, you know, a protein has certain structure. In the case of alpha-synuclein, it actually doesn't have much of a structure. And normally it binds to these vesicles that are inside nerve cells. And somehow that, you know, that instead of binding to nerve cells, and somehow that the alpha-synuclein molecule has a altered conformation or bad conformation. It may go from binding like this and to maybe like that. And then somehow that this bad conformation can attract the normal protein and suck it up or recruit it and into pathology. And so the pathology keep expanding within cells. And so this is a common phenomenon. And what we've done, which is really exciting in the last 3 years, and it's somewhat of a paradigm shift, if I may say, and in building models for neurodegenerative diseases, is the fact that we can actually use the protein in animals that are not genetically engineered. And some of you might remember what Dr. Brandon says. These are just wild-type mice, annual mice, and then you can actually inject this preparation that we misfolded preparation that we can actually produce in a test tube and then and inject it into mice and then watch it spread over time. And actually, and I illustrated that in my talk by just saying injecting in one area, but you can inject it in many areas and you can see spreading. But the spreading is different, obviously, if you inject the fibril into the area which regulate learning and memory, like the hippocampus, then the spreading is according to the connection from hippocampus to elsewhere of the brain, in the brain. And so the other things that are really exciting about this paradigm is that we have collaborated with other investigators in the field in Parkinson's disease area. And this approach also apply in a rat. So in other words, that you can take a wild-type rat, any rat that you want, and you can inject some fibrils in, and bingo, you get the pathology, you get the spread of the pathology. I believe that it also works in monkeys, and although it's premature at this point to talk much about it, but preliminary data suggests that it would also work in monkey. And here you're looking at a totally different kind of modeling, and basically not genetic engineer, it represents sporadic Parkinson's disease. And also, based on the model, there are really very, very complicated ways in which we can use this model to look for ways in which we can come up with therapy. And Dr. Brandon mentioned some of the approaches, for example, for the cell to be able to spread, for the alpha-synuclein pathology to spread, it must do two things. It must take up this bad protein inside the cell, and it must somehow, inside when it is inside the cell, expand and make more pathology. And also, it must be released. So there's three different windows of opportunity, if you will, that we can come up with medicine that could interfere with all of these processes that could potentially could use to treat Parkinson's disease. And also because we have cell culture model too, and that again allow you to be able to use that as a platform to identify therapies. And then the other area using this model too, and it would speak to what Dr. Schlossmacher was saying in terms of biomarkers. For example, our model, you can look in the spinal fluid or even in blood to see whether or not you can see alpha-synuclein in the spinal fluid or even antibody in the blood, because there have been some papers suggesting autoantibody of alpha-synuclein can be detected in Parkinson's patient. And so there are many ways in which you can use the model to address many, many different things. And I think that because of the simplicity of the models, and we can use the model for many things. And then finally, the last point I want to make is that Parkinson's disease is not one disease, it's a syndrome. And there are many, many other clinical manifestations. I think one of the most devastating manifestations of Parkinson's disease is cognitive impairment. And in fact, most of the people that develop Parkinson's disease at a later stage of their life inevitably would have cognitive impairment if they live with the disease for more than 10 years. And so I think that the spreading of synuclein to the cortex could partly be responsible for this cognitive impairment. But at the same time, there are also other pathology in brains of patients that have a cognitive impairment and with Parkinson's disease. They have amyloid plaques, and they also have tau tangles. So what are their contribution to the dementia? How do they interact with alpha-synuclein within the cell? And those are the things that we want to address. We want to address the fact that there may be differences between Parkinson and alpha-synuclein aggregates in parts of the brain that develop amyloid plaques and tau tangles. And we think that they're different strain. And the alpha-synuclein can actually change when they're going to one cell to another. Or even within the same cell, they can change their shape and then could go from one strain to another strain. So these are maybe a bit too esoteric for you right now, but a lot of these things are related, and we always go back to the human brain and trying to understand what's wrong with the human brain and then trying to model them either in cells or in animals. And I think that, you know, I'm very excited about Parkinson's and treatment for Parkinson's right now. I think from the point of view of model development, we are better, I emphasize, we have better models than for Alzheimer's disease, which is another disease I also worked on.
I think that's, as you say, an important point, particularly Parkinson's, is finally moving on, I think.
Yes, the models
quickly,
are much
it's,
better
it's
now.
It's very encouraging. Right. Dr. Fishbein, did you want
yes.
to?
Here. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
And then we'll throw it open for general questions, yeah?
Could I just make one point, which was on the diet?
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, so, Roger. Yeah.
I just wanted to make a point on the diagnosis, because what Virginia said is a very important point. So a study we've done, for example, in Cambridge is to follow people over time with Parkinson's from the point of diagnosis. And part of the diagnosis is not just diagnosing Parkinson's disease, but the subtyping. So stratification, who develops a dementia earlier? And just to give you an idea, it may relate to some of this protein spread. For example, in our cohort, if you're over 72 and you have a particular genetic makeup, so you have a particular tau haplotype, a GBA mutation, you can't produce a list of 20 animals in 90 seconds, you can't draw into a lot of pentagons, your chances of being demented with Parkinson's within 5 years is 88-fold greater than if you don't. So stratification at diagnosis is now possible, which may open up new pathogenic pathways. So it may be one disease, but with different kinetics. So I just wanted to make the point that diagnosis is not just Parkinson's disease, but subtyping, which I forgot to mention.
Dr. Fishbein.
Okay, so thank you. So the work I've been involved in is basically also regards alpha-synuclein, but we tried to connect it and understand the interaction between alpha-synuclein and another risk factor, genetic risk factor for PD, which is the carrier for the disease, for the Gaucher disease. Now, Gaucher disease is a disease that involves a problem with the lysosome, which is one organelle in the cell that allows to degrade proteins. And we know that alpha-synuclein is degraded in this organelle, so it makes this almost intuitive connection. But the problem with this connection is that Gaucher disease is a recessive disease, which means that basically we have one intact copy of the Gaucher gene is enough usually to keep the lysosome functioning. So what we came and we asked, is it really possible that this heterozygosity, which means only one damage copy of the gene is enough to interfere with alpha-synuclein degradation and eventually bring it to build up in the cells and create toxicity. And we were privileged that we had several genetic models that we could combine, and we could use both in vivo testing these mice in vivo and how they behave, their pathology. And we could use them to create neuronal cultures, which are a wonderful tool, I think, to do this stuff. And I was very lucky that the committee allowed me to... originally, I submitted a poster, and I was the topic was chosen as a hot topic, so I get to present it in front of a larger crowd.
Okay, I'm very keen to make sure that we have time for your questions. So you've heard a lot of very exciting science, I think, and... especially significant moves on from the last WPC in Glasgow in 2010. Do we have any questions?
I want to make one additional comment. So going back to biomarkers, I don't know if I'm sorry, it's late, whether you talk about imaging biomarkers. And so as you know that right now, and there are ways and other ways to determine if someone has Alzheimer's disease, and you have heard of these imaging the plaques in the brain. And recently, very recently, two or three places, one in Japan, one Eli Lilly, and another place in Europe, they developed ligand that you can image these tangles in Alzheimer's brain. But now, and many laboratories, and there are at least two or three laboratories, are working on identifying and chemicals that can detect Lewy body in living patients. So why is this so important? Because when the patient is asymptomatic, you can, you know, use the ligand to see whether or not it lights up and which detects Lewy body in brains. So I think that those are technology of the future, and they would improve and diagnosis. And so with the biomarker that Michael was talking about, and plus, you know, clinical tests and plus imaging tools and also genetic, I think that we would be able to diagnose patients earlier and then provide different treatment.
Marie-Françoise, you had a comment.
So I would like to comment on what Dr. Fischbein said, the connection between Gaucher disease and alpha-synuclein pathology in Parkinson's disease. That already led to a potential neuroprotective strategy that takes advantage of the fact that people have developed drugs to treat Gaucher disease, that we found in models of alpha-synuclein pathology to improve the alpha-synuclein pathology. So even in patients that do not have Gaucher disease, this interaction led us to a strategy that is now being developed for clinical applications. It's not in patients yet, but the preclinical work suggests that it may work, and it's derived from this genetic evidence that linked Gaucher disease with Parkinson's disease, and then basic research that led to a connection between alpha-synuclein and the gene that's affected in Gaucher. So you see how this very basic research and the genetic efforts are already leading towards therapies that then, to be really tested in humans, need the biomarker.
Yes.
And more accurate diagnosis. So you see how everything is linked.
But I mean, it's very important, this interaction, because certainly within our cohort, for example, when people have a GBA mutation, they don't look any different when they present with their Parkinson's, but every single patient in our cohort demented within 8 years with a GBA mutation. So the important point is that some of these genetic variants don't influence when you get Parkinson's disease, but they certainly influence how your Parkinson's behaves thereafter. And that opens up, I think, a completely different therapeutic landscape, because it's not one treatment for all. Stratifying patients into these different subtypes will influence where you put your therapies and your therapeutic efforts in the future.
I think it's also true, even as simple as difference between men and women, that men and women have a different onset of Parkinson's in terms of age, but marginally, and yet they don't differ at all in terms of progression. Sorry, a question, yes.
I don't find this is very interesting and exciting, and I'm wanting to take us a little further. So the models that Dr. B explained and what have you. So when you say earlier treatment for a person with Parkinson's once you've been diagnosed, does that mean that their symptoms will be less apparent, they will be able to live longer? What does it mean for a patient if there's an early diagnose that is not here right now? What does it look like? Because we'll have better medication, or if I'm early diagnosed, what does it mean to me?
Well, I think that's a very good question. It addresses two issues. Number one is the brain and the heart are two organs where cells don't renew at a significant rate. In other words, that not all of them, but most of the cells that we're born with in the heart and in the brain stay stable. So when there's an injury that happens because of an illness such as Parkinson's disease, and Dr. Chesalea talked about this a little bit, how do you repair it? How do you protect it? So the reason why most of the people in the field, and also not just scientists but physicians, feel that early diagnosis is important is if you have what's called disease-modifying intervention, in other words, you have a drug or a treatment that actually slows down the train toward full picture of Parkinson's, you want to identify people as early as possible and then slow down that train. And even slowing it down by 10, 15 years might be all that we need to do, right? So it's the issue of how soon can you intervene to maintain a very high level of functioning. The second aspect is that many people in the field think, I don't necessarily agree with it, but most people in the field think that when a significant amount of damage has been done, meaning the train has left the station and has covered 50-60% of the distance to travel, it is so much harder to see that you have a benefit even if you have the right treatment. In other words, somebody with severe pneumonia and goes into acute respiratory distress syndrome, you may have the right antibiotic for the drug, but the lung damage has been so severe that you can't improve the situation, even though you had the right treatment. So that's another incentive for many people in the field to think we have to go in early, diagnose with accuracy who has the illness, come up with the right target and the right medicine to engage that target, and then slow down that train. I don't think that's 100% the answer, because I also work with stroke patients, and they're devastating strokes, really devastating strokes, yet the brain has an amazing plasticity potential left to repair even devastating strokes. So I'm not as pessimistic as most people are in the Alzheimer's field or even Parkinson's, saying that we have to do this very early. I would predict, if I had a crystal ball, that if we have the right target engagement, that we will also be able to slow down and modify and help people who are more advanced in their disease. But it's totally speculative at this time. I'm not in the majority with this opinion, but I'm very optimistic because I see what happens in stroke patients who survive and can recover.
Do we have any other?
I would second that because I try to explain, even if we, in our animal model, see dysfunction and see real pathology and see a lot of damage already done, with the experimental treatment that we can use in animals that are not yet in people, we can see reversal of those deficits. So I share Michael's optimism.
And in another very nice study, which was done many years ago in a completely different disease, Huntington's disease, it was a very nice study where they did this mouse where they put the Huntington's disease gene in. They got the mouse to have pathology. They got the mouse to have behavioral deficit. Then they were able to switch the gene off. And it wasn't just the mouse stabilized. The mouse actually improved. So the pathology improved, and then their behavior improved. And there was a very nice study again last year in Huntington's where they knocked out the gene for Huntington's using a thing called interfering RNA, got rid of it for a brief period of time. So not a very long period of time, but the mouse improved for much longer than the protein had disappeared. So I think there's this, I think when you've got these proteins misbehaving or causing cells to misbehave, if you can rescue the cell, just make it a bit better for a while, it actually has a consequence much beyond that. So it's almost like the cell has a chance to now recover, can fight another day, and so you can move on. So I think these therapies, where we talk about knocking things out permanently for long periods of time, it might not be that necessary to be that Dragonian, if you like,
then. Right. We actually did a study and using synuclein, and we basically have a mouse model that developed alpha synuclein pathology, and showing that it compromised the ways that at the synapse. So in other words, that this degeneration at the synapse, and so we then turn off this expression of the alpha synuclein, and the synapses recover. And over a few months, and it was a paper we published 2 years ago in the Journal of Neuroscience, and so it speaks to the fact that the cells are still plastic and can recover, and so I think that early treatment, for example, and taking a lesson from Alzheimer's field, that they use antibody now to treat patients that are either very very early in the disease or maybe even have no disease at all, so to see whether that would prevent actually the disease onset.
I think that's certainly an area of huge interest these days, and something that we probably weren't talking about anywhere nearly interestedly 3 years back. Certainly changed. Do we have one last question? Because I'm aware that time is rushing by. I'm also aware that it was me that caused us to lose some time. So, do we have any last questions? In which case, thank you.
We confuse you so much.
If you've been baffled with science, I mean... that's bad, but I hope that was helpful.
Thank you for your interest.
And thanks to the panel.
I just want to thank our panel. Is it on? I just want to. What happened? Died. I think he shut it off.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.